Hi and welcome to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. Michelle Rayner with you this afternoon. Today, the experiences of one wave of migrants who came to Australia about 40 years ago. In the wake of the violent military coup in their country in September 1973, thousands of Chileans migrated to Australia. Some of them had been victims of torture and imprisonment. Others fled the increasing repression of the junta, which deposed socialist president Salvador Allende and established a long reign of military government under General Augusto Pinochet. That's coming up in the second half of the hour. Right now, though, it's the third instalment of the series Australian Generations, where three age groups of people have been reflecting on growing up in this country across four decades. Last week, the focus was on memories of school. Today, it's all about life outside the school gates, the time when we might have felt, especially in childhood, that real sense of freedom. But as you'll hear, while the pleasure gain from play and social life remains a constant, what has changed is the nature of that play itself. Here's Episode 3 of Australian Generations, Playtime.
The neighbour had two children, same age as me and my brother, and then the family next to them had two children as well, same age as my brother and I. And then across the road from them was another family who had two kids. I think we kind of made a pathway through our backyards. We would just go straight through the backyards.
I think once we got home from school, you wouldn't spend a great deal of time inside because you get bored with that pretty quickly. And you'd be off outside. It was always friends across the street or six houses down.
Where rocking horses and pedal cars and those sort of things. There really wasn't enough room for playing cricket in the backyard in those days, but we tried. And fortunately, being on the corner of a street meant we had this very long nature strip that ran down the side of the street on the public side of the fence. And so that afforded a natural cricket pitch and even a bit of a football field in winter.
I enjoyed riding the bike. You know, Dad did up this second-hand bike, and I used to, that was great because I used to be able to get around a lot better, and I remember that. And yabbing in the channel, which was just down the road from us, you know, that was great fun. Playing alleys, marbles. I used to collect, sounds funny now, but cigarette cards. Used to paste the in a booklet, which I unfortunately lost. It was, quite a good collection.
Played the usual, you know, in the younger days, cowboys and Indians running around the place, and then I was in the Scouts. That was a good experience for a bloke that didn't have a father.
This is television.
Who said Australia wasn't a land of opportunity?
When television arrived, 1956, two doors from us, the Botts, Mr. and Mrs. Bott, they were the first people in the neighbourhood to get a television. So every Wednesday night there for a period, there was about half a dozen kids. We would all, 7:30, present ourselves at Mrs. Bott's place, sit in a row on the floor with our legs crossed right in front of the TV and watch Rin Tin Tin.
Yeah, I would be back for lunch or we'll be back for dinner. And we always knew that back for dinner would mean, you know, around that 5 o'clock, 5:30 period. So you'd always try and make sure you were back by that time.
We always ate late. We ate at 7 o'clock. I'd be, in the summertime, I'd be playing out in the streets with whoever. And 5:30, 6 o'clock, there's Mum calling the kids in. And there I'd be from 6 o'clock till 7 o'clock, what am I going to do? I've got no one to play with.
The wild times, I think, used to happen at the weekends where you had a bit more free rein, where you could disappear in the morning and return at nightfall. I can remember as a kid that the lake was pretty much really just a refuge. It was a dump on the north side of the lake, really was a tip. It was a bit of a wild sort of a place, just trees and bush and car bodies you could crawl through and frogs to collect and trees to climb. And I was always told by Mum as I left, don't you dare go down to that lake at all. And I said, no, not at all. I won't go near the lake, Mum. And of course, the first place she headed for was the lake. But we used to yabby and do all that sort of thing. As I said, you used to find old car bodies. We found a hacksaw blade one day, and it took us something like 2 or 3 weeks to take the top of a car we disemboweled the car and we cut the roof off it, and then we used the roof as a raft.
Our local picture theatre was called the Rivoli Picture Theatre, and Saturday afternoons, kids would go to the afternoon Saturday afternoon matinee, and after lunch, I can recall just seeing the street filled with children that were walking in the same direction,
yeah,
excited about the same thing.
If I went to the pictures, Dad would give me sixpence, and that was a big deal. I could buy a two and one for about threepence halfpenny, and I could buy get in for the pictures for about five or sixpence, something like, give me extra money, you know. And main movies, it used to be like the musicals in those days, you know, Technicolor. Yes, take us in, the lolly boy come around with his, what do you call it, the around his neck, you know, with the lollies, and walk up and down the aisle.
Yeah, mid-teens, it was a lot of movies. We'd have to go into the city for movies, actually, or up to the airport. In those days, there's this white building, which is still there, but it was in those days it was the Astrojet Space and Science Centre in about 1970 or something like that. And we would hop on our bikes and ride up there and watch movies, because they actually had a cinema in there. And so we watched a lot of things. Like, I remember watching Love Story. I was at the age when we used to go to movies to cry. Gone with the Wind came back. They had a revival of Gone with the Wind. Went and Gone with the Wind when I was about 15 in the city and bawled my eyes out and had a lovely time.
Well, I guess in the younger years it was just, you know, shopping expeditions with girlfriends. We used to catch the train into the city on a Saturday morning, which was quite an exercise of getting the bus into Lilydale and then catching the train. It took about 2 hours, I think, to come in, and then we'd have 4 or 5 hours in the city roaming around, and then go back and sleepovers and all that kind of thing.
One night the Moxhams would come to our place and the two girls would sleep in my bed. And the next Saturday I would go to the Moxhams and I'd sleep in their bed. Yes, and I can remember playing music and some of the little 45 plastic records, the different colours, they were the ones for children. So we'd play some records for the children, for us, and then it was time to go to bed, girls.
Growing up with the radio as being the central entertainment device in the house meant that part of the family ritual around tea time was the radio would be turned on, and so we'd hear whatever was on that time, at that time of day. But I remember the radio serial Blue Hills was still going in those days, and I imagine most people of our generation have that theme tune etched in their brains forever. Almost became sort of themes in our lives in a way.
The search for the golden boomerang.
I remember listening the radio serials too. They were influenced on me on listening to the ABC. And a local station was 3SR, Shepparton came from.
As a teenager living in a country town, I would subscribe to Princess magazine that came from England, and my mother used to get Women's Weekly.
Going back to my mother going to Lygon Street every Friday she'd bring me home a new book, and she'd say, look, Grace, I'm giving you these books, I just wish I could give you my books that we could read together, but you don't read Italian, I don't read English. And then as I got a little bit older, she used to always buy me Enid Blyton books.
I read Enid Blyton constantly when I was in primary school. And I got into Agatha Christie, and as I got older, I got more into sort of teenage romance type stuff for a while. And I think that was probably when I was in high school. And I don't know what my brother did while I was reading. It's probably... He was much more active, sporty kind of kid. So he was probably throwing a tennis ball for hours on end.
Once you were older, of course, you got involved in sports. After school, you'd be off training, doing something involved in your major sport. But...
I love sport. And, I used to thunder up and down playing hockey. When I was at the previous school, I played in their netball team.
You know, we had a big oval and we would have lots of athletics competitions. So we used to do a lot of running, and the parents were always involved in organising the sporting days. And so I can remember my father was there either shooting the gun to send us off or being there to accept the winners. So running, I always loved the running.
they call them the Bickham's tennis courts. They're now being converted into units, but in those days, an old, what I thought was an old chappy, we'd go around there and play, and there's only three of us, taught us all sorts of things about tennis.
And then I joined the pony club here, which was just a riding club really in those days. Well, I used to ride out into the forest, into the whipstick and down country lanes, and did very well with it. I went to all the shows. My Sheila was her official name. A horse with great presence, a very, really beautiful mare. And I did well with her in the shows and used to share a truck. And five or six horses be loaded on a truck and we'd go to Castlemaine or somewhere where things were on. I was swimming champion at the Teachers College. We swam in was really a mine dam. Just had a bit of fixtures around the edge.
I was always a bit of a runner. I wasn't 6 foot or 6 foot four, and running never really appealed to me. So when I was at secondary school, there was a competition that they used to run called the Schoolboy Cycling Event, and I got involved with that. I ended up joining the Northcote Amateurs Cycling Club. I was racing in the era of they used to have the old velodrome in Swansea, and even, you know, met people from other parts of the world, Italians and all that sort of stuff.
What was happening in the community, there was a development of a club called the Fitzroy Stars Football Club, and some of the people that were organising the club said, let's get some good young kids to come and play. So they said, come and play with us, and I was 16. Because of the Koori community, and my dad was going to be involved in the club and all that, you know, eventually I went there. And it's been one of the badges of honour that I wear quite proudly, to be involved in this magnificent club.
I used to belong to the Coburg Harriers. I ran amateur running for them, and they used to have an annual ball in the Alexander Gardens there each year, and I remember drumming up a few of the friends. We'd go to these annual balls that they had there.
I'd try to go out to a dance and do those sort of usual things that young people do. Like, I remember with my second girlfriend, bus from Murray Road, Gilbert Road tram, all the way to Hutton Street, Thornbury, get the bus that'll take us to the Heidelberg Town Hall for a Saturday night dance.
But at that time, I can remember going to Heidelberg Town Hall, and you used to have to wear a tie to get in the door. The gentleman had to have a tie. And the place was absolutely full.
Used to jitterbug, do the modern. Oh, it was fantastic. Friday night, a dress-up, A-line dress. We dressed well in those days. Then Palm Grove, that's Earl's Court. You ever heard of Earl's Court in St Kilda? Oh, that's where a lot of, from Melbourne University, a lot of the students used to go there, and it was sort of the in thing to go. And I'll never forget the time, I shouldn't play this. But I got home about 11:30. And this time I thought, we had the big windows. You know those big windows in those mansions of a house my mum had in North Carlton, Rathdown Street? And I lifted the window up and I thought, I'll hop in this way, because the door was locked and Father thinking it's in. So I hopped in, and next I hear this scream. And I scream. My sister and her future husband were on the couch and the locked, and I jumped on top of it. Wake up everyone in the house.
They had a band that were fairly regular, I can't remember their name, but, and the music is just amazing. Like, big band music is just phenomenal. But yeah, rock and roll stuff as well, and you'd all, you know, there'd be same sort of thing, dance floor in the middle, and you all used to roam the outside.
The Preston Town Hall was famous for their Saturday night rock and roll dance, because my brother at that time, he was what was in those days called a bodgy, and I remember him dressing up in a suede, blue suede shoes, Presley purple socks and a white sports coat.
I can remember when living in Collingwood, well, I would have been 10 or 11, and they used to do a live music show, I think a ghost set or something, and we would go there for the recording of it. And I can remember watching Normie Rowe, Masters Apprentices, some of them real early 70s bands then. And it was just sensational. I used to think I was as good as 10 men. I'd have this real good jean jacket on or something like that, and I'd go up there.
And I can remember we'd go to the Croxton Park, we'd go to the Burvale Pub, or we'd go to the Council Club, which is down here. And And we were seeing acts, you know, we used to go to Braithwaite with Billy Thorpe and Brian Cadd and Doug Parkinson and Renee Geyer and at the time of Twilight. So that was all just a pub scene.
The Station Hotel, which was a famous or infamous music venue in Melbourne in those days. Even if you're a band or a performer, people used to aspire to playing at the Station. It was only a small little backstreet corner pub and pram, and it was fantastic.
You've been listening to Episode 3, Playtime, from the series Australian Generations. Thanks to all those who took part, and to producer Sarah Rudd and sound engineer Gary Havrilay. Next week, in the second last episode of the series, it's all about family. The late British poet Philip Larkin has a memorable but unmentionable saying about them. But for some, families are the glue which binds society and gives life its cohesion. Join me for Hindsight next week to hear how three generations of Australians talk about the meaning and impact of family in their lives. And you're with Hindsight on ABC Radio National. Those words, long live Chile, long live the people, long live the workers, were the final utterances of Chilean President Salvador Allende before he was assassinated in a military coup in September 1973. Those events ushered in one of the longest periods of military government in Latin America, when the junta, headed up by General Augusto Pinochet, took power and held it for the following 17 years. In the period after the military came to power, amid violent repression by the state, including the arrest and torture of anyone suspected of dissent, clandestine concentration camps, curfews and censorship, many Chileans sought exile around the world, including Australia.
My name is Carolina Castillo. I was 1 year old when General Augusto Pinochet seized control of Chile in 1973. And forced my parents and many others from their homeland. These are some of their stories of exile in Australia.
After Salvador Allende, who had been the world's one and only elected Marxist president, Ray Martin has the background from New York.
Chile has long been the political anomaly in Latin America. Unlike its neighbors,
Mexican early afternoon papers are giving 4-inch
more vivid memory I have September 11 was that I realized that I never was going to be able to go back to my place. I remember that nearly 5:30 in the morning, I went to my parents' bedroom and woke them up and I said goodbye with a kiss. I went to my brother and I remember that I woke him up, I kissed him and he stand in his bed and he carried me and said to me, look after yourself, you know. Knowing that he didn't realize the magnitude of what that carol meant for me. And I left home and I was right. I never was able to go back to my place.
Levántate y mira la montaña de donde viene el viento, el sol y el agua.
I mean, the people we saw through the windows were people trying to get home. A lot of army movement. You will see vans and trucks and army people going somewhere. Helicopters and airplanes and all that movement.
At the time of the coup, I did have to go as normal to university. And I arrived there, and when we were hearing some comments on the radio, that was something funny was going on in Valparaíso. Guns going off everywhere in the city. So I just continued, I went to uni, and we arrived there and we saw the tanks surrounding the campus and then start shooting at the building, students and all that stuff. So it was very terrible scene. So I have to just run away, escape, and seeing friends being shot. No, it was a very terrible experience.
So the beginning of 1973 was exciting. It was my first year at uni until September 1973, where the coup occurred, and all my dreams and hopes were absolutely cut off from one minute to another. The Popular Unity Government of Salvador Allende was elected in 1970 with a mandate for comprehensive social and economic change. But the president's reforms, particularly the nationalization of the country's copper industry, angered foreign investors. They retaliated by cutting off loans to Chile, and the CIA carried out a multi-million dollar campaign to destabilize the government. Mounting social unrest, fueled by rising inflation, gave General Pinochet, the army's commander-in-chief, an excuse to act.
Atención para conocimiento de la opinión pública de Santiago.
His aim was not only to topple Allende, but also to rid the country of all those who supported the government's progressive agenda. Victor Marijanka was a university student when the coup occurred. He also taught literacy skills in the shanty towns around Santiago, which made him a prime target for the military.
They took all my clothes off first and they tied up and blindfolded and showed me water, dirty water. Felt probably was just excrement and urine, probably, and all the smell and all that stuff. And then they start to apply electric shocks everywhere. And so it was a very, very heavy stuff they did on me, with the knuckles, you know, on my ribs and hitting me with the rifle butts. They broke my chest and my ankles. And they stopped that when I was bleeding completely, and I wouldn't answer. They wanted to know about weapons and about the organization they said I had, and also who were the people working with me. And I would say I didn't know anything. So I worked on my own. So then they took me to the Comandante Acuñas, that's the guy in charge there. They took me in front of him, still tied up, my hands on my back, and blindfolded and naked. And they just threw me in front of this guy from the army, this commander. And they took my blindfold off. And they lift my head so I could see the guy. And then he asked me again to give all the information to him, and he would take me home. No problems. I told him I didn't know anything about it. So this guy, a big, huge guy, about 100 kilos, I suppose, came to me and just kicked me on my face, on my left-hand side, with his big army boots. As I pass out, and you know, then a few days later, I suppose I just got in consciousness again, and just sitting next to my bed where I was, there was a guy there from the army with his machine gun pointing at me. Yeah, I saw I was going to die. I saw I was going to die. How cool those people just like me doing that to me.
In the days following the coup, thousands were rounded up, tortured and killed. Small groups tried to fight the junta, but were hopelessly outnumbered. The brother of Patricio Vázquez joined the armed revolt, but died in a gun battle. Patricio remembers that his father also came to the notice of the military and was arrested, although his activities were far from subversive.
Well, my father's political involvement was minimal, in that I would consider being a member of a trade union something minimal. My brother, on the other hand, was very much involved, but it didn't matter whether or not my father was involved deeply in politics. What mattered was the fact that he was known in the community and they had suspicions about him. And in those days, it didn't matter whether or not they had any real evidence against you or not. Suspicion was enough to wipe someone out, basically, because they wanted to eradicate any potential Marxist thinking people from the population. And as you know, within the first 3 or 4 months, Chile lost approximately 25,000 lives.
Orillitas del canal, cuando
llega la mañana, sale cantando la noche desde lo de Valderrama.
We were living in Santiago when the news of my brother's death came. We had to go back to claim his body and to try and bury him. You know, we had to look for the body. The body was given to us, but in a box that was sealed, not to be opened. And it was only about 1.20 meters long. My brother used to have a height of about 1.80 meters. And when my brother asked what happened, why it was such a small coffin, they said, well, he was cut in half in the confrontation, so we decided to fold him to save on timber.
Well, they put me the first couple of days, you know, in a very small cell, full of rats, dead and alive. And then after a couple of days, they moved it to the central detention center, where I meet a lot of people when I work with. Well, I am not alone, because the first feeling in the first couple of days was, what happened with me? What are you doing? I got a very important friend who was detained with me, Dr. Enriquez. He was a chief of the health department in that province. They put electricity in their testicle, you know. And one night, he was took out of the cell, and then they announced in the radio he was killed because he tried to run away. I understood in that moment, you know, the terror. How strong was the situation? Because that meant they couldn't move, so they can't run away, you see. Just they kill, you know. I was in that center when my bishop and the family of my wife, who were right-wing people, they took me out of the prison and they gave me home arrest. One of my brother-in-law, who was involved in the coup in that province, he took me away to Santiago, 800 kilometers, in a box of the truck, and they put me in the French embassy. So I got political asylum there. They took me about 4 months before I get, you know, permission to leave the country.
Gustavo Martin was an active member of the Christian Left and president of the Popular Unity Movement in his province of Temuco. He and his wife Alicia arrived in Sydney in February 1974, the first Chileans to be offered refuge in Australia. In the months and years following the coup, more than 1 million people, or about 10% of the population, left Chile in search of sanctuary in other countries. Juanita Zapata was another who had to find an alternative home.
I was expelled from Chile in February 1974. I was sent to Argentina. It wasn't my choice, it was a decision that was made for me, on my behalf, between the military and my family, really. I mean, the options were to stay in Chile and face trial, or to leave Chile and never come back. And my family opted to let me go.
My picture was put in the newspaper, and the military went 3 times, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, to my parents' home, and they put my father, actually, under a lot of pressure to try to convince me to go back to the city and give myself up to the military. According to them, the reason that they want me to go back is they want to ask me some question about what was happening in the university. I remember one of my university friends, also a member of my political party, and he received some news through the channels that the military also want him back to present himself to the bar, because they have only just some question for him. I recall him so vivid that he tried to convince me, Kamran Alexis, give up ourselves. The only thing that I want to do is ask some question about the university movement. I don't know why I told him no, no, no. He never appeared again. And he's just one of the thousands of disappeared cases in Chile.
Alexis Mesa, another university student targeted for his left-wing allegiance, went underground before making his way to Australia. For my parents, Reinaldo and Maritza Castillo, the coup saddened as well as frightened them. They watched as their community disintegrated around them. Neighbour turned against neighbour, and families were torn apart by divided loyalties. Trust was a luxury most people couldn't afford if they wanted to wake up in their own beds in the morning. My mother never really talked much about this, as she had learnt to hide her feelings. But when I was 13, I found something, a poem she had written which showed me the extent of her loss. She wrote, "I have seen, like a defeated army, my books perish in the flames. I cried over the destroyed Moneda Palace, while people celebrated with champagne not so far away."
I started feeling very scared and more scared every day. And I suppose that I only rest when I left the country. You were advised to go to bed with warm clothes instead of people who were going to go and take you during the night. Always to be with your child, always let everyone know where you were going and with whom. Our friends starting being taken and disappearing. Others
picking
at random. Yeah. So it could be that, or it would be tonight. Tonight they're going to go into my house.
It's going to be tonight. The terror, and that was totally at random.
It's going to be tonight. It was, you know, increasing panic really. First, you thought that the left would be able to retake the power, but then you realized that no, that wasn't going to happen. I wasn't prepared to hide who I was, or I wasn't intelligent enough, I assume, or I don't know, to try to pretend that I wasn't a left-wing person. I was ready to argue with anyone and everyone.
And you did.
I did. I was putting myself in danger, and I was aware of that.
I was still working, you know, going to the office every day, and I was seeing people coming out of torture. And then they would come to the office and I said, nothing happened to me, you know. They were very good to me. They didn't do a thing. And then they would show me all the torture mark in the body, and because they said, it's so good to talk to you because I never panic or cry or anything. I just took everything in, you know. But I was receiving all that pain. I was seeing all that in my co-workers in the office, and every day someone would disappear, or every day a group of the army would come to the office to pick someone up, and it was horrible. And Gustavo would still want to stay. He said, you know, we could do something, we could go somewhere. And I said, no, that's it, I'm leaving.
Apart from the usual problems of migration, like learning a new language and coming to terms with a different culture, the Chileans had other burdens. Many were still haunted by the terror they'd experienced at home, and few Australians could understand what they'd gone through. The Martins found that even the established Chilean community was uninterested in their plight.
So when we arrived here, we were in so many ways received by those people, right? And when we told them our personal story, they didn't believe. They didn't believe, just simply like that.
Well, sometimes they say, oh, this story is too grotesque. Please don't repeat that in front of my friends.
Yeah.
And that was very, very painful as well, because you felt so isolated from your own community.
When they arrived in Australia, I remember walking down the streets of Wollongong with my mother in the early days, and when there were sirens, police sirens, or even ambulance sirens, which she couldn't differentiate between the two, she would become very nervous and would stop and look, and her hand grip would always become tighter, and you could feel shaking also, because she was very traumatized when we left Chile, given the fact that, first of all, we went through the experience of my father having been in prison. Then the fact that my brother, the older brother, was killed, that was just the biggest blow that she could ever had.
Here in Canberra, when I arrived in 1975, there was no community organizations. There were only three or four persons from that country, and there were persons who ran away from Allende, let's say, or who left the country before. So it was very hard. I used to, you know, just sit there and cry and drink. But what could I do? I was still alive. And to be in a situation like that, it is very, very, very hard. Not being able to get back to your country, not being able to communicate with your families at that time when they were checking all the mail in and out of the country, especially in cases like mine.
It was very important for me in that at that time to explain to everybody that I didn't come here to seek a better economical situation, but because I had to survive. So I was different. I wanted to let everybody know that I was different. I didn't come here for the money. I came here just to survive. You cannot imagine the horrors of being, you know, in a situation like that. So they said, okay, you are okay now, you are safe. Mm. It's like being safe, you can separate yourself from all that situation. Mm. And that's the worst part, that you cannot, because you are part of that and you are mine. Doesn't say, okay, now I'm safe, I cut all the memories, and now I will live a different life. From now on, I will be happy. You know, it doesn't work like that.
We didn't buy furniture, we didn't, we lived in very small places because we were always returning. I mean, we had our leaders when we were coming to Australia, you know, from time to time, and every time they left, we were led to believe that we would be back in Chile in 6 months' time, 3 months, 1 year at the most.
While grateful to be able to find refuge in Australia, most Chileans didn't plan to stay. Their bags were packed, metaphorically at least, for the return journey that they hoped would soon begin. For my mother, life in a new land was particularly difficult. Unlike my father, she had no relatives here. But nonetheless, she was determined not to be beaten.
In a way, I didn't want to feel defeated person living in the country.
We didn't want to be victims.
So I sort of convinced myself that I was like in a sort of, always wanted to go outside the country to study. So I thought this is the opportunity. In a way, this is an opportunity for me. So I'll take it as an opportunity. I will be there for about 3 years or something, and then I'll go back. It was an understanding that all my family expected me to go back after a few years, because Pinochet wouldn't last that long.
My parents' intention at the time, I always remember, was that this is going to be a short-term stay outside the country, no more than 3 years. I saw that my parents lived in a constant desire to get things ready for the trip. They lived with that desire for many, many years, and in fact, even nowadays, they still are in constant, wish to go back.
I was with a friend of mine, an Australian girl, and we were at Bondi Beach. And then I said, well, you know, I love Bondi so much, it's so beautiful. And she said, you don't have to go. It was very emotional for me to realize that.
Now, therefore, I, Sir John Robert Kerr, the Governor General of Australia, do by this.
The proclamation which you have just heard read by the Governor General's official secretary was countersigned Malcolm Fraser.
Well, on that day, on the 11th of November 1975, I was also sacked from Parliament House. I was working there as a kitchen hand. The chef called me and with an interpreter, and he told me that my job was terminated. And then I went home and I learned also what was happening in the politics in general. And all those sort of things went on my head. I said, well, the government was sacked. Just ran away from Chile, where the government of Chile was overthrown. What's going to happen here? Will I have to be escaping or running away from this country to another country?
So in a way, at that time, I have my own feelings. I was analyzing the situation from my point of view and my hopelessness. Then I'm thinking, well, you know, we will never win.
It's another defeat.
Another defeat.
I think we tend to identify him with Allende in some way. Because yes, they are both very charismatic figures, you know, strong personalities, leaders,
yeah,
real
right.
leaders.
Yeah.
So we were so sad when that thing with Whitlam happened, really, that we hate Fraser. But later on, I would say that Allende Fraser along the year became a very decent person, and I think...
Probably he was originally accepted.
Yes, I was wrong, that's what I am saying, that we were very emotional about this thing, you know, the beginning,
yes.
Of course. Right? We have to leave a country, to leave a way of life to come here, and then not again.
Mr. Fraser, do you regard this as a vote against Mr. Whitlam, his policies, or a vote against socialism?
It's a vote against both, I think. But I would be very...
Andrew Pico was the man
well,
in
yes.
charge of the
yeah.
external affair, and he was quite good with the solidarity movement. Where I am here, nothing will go to help Pinochet. We started to distinguish in being a right-wing person and to be a fascist.
Fitting into Australian society also proved difficult for other reasons. Always hopeful of a return to Chile, they were keen to maintain their cultural identity. This left little room for integration. Patricio Vasquez.
They not so much didn't adapt, they didn't want to adapt in this country. They didn't also wish to get to know the language until about 5 years when my mother went to the first English classes. And that was basically because she needed to work. And my father was working in the steelworks, whereby we didn't have any English language learning on the job those days.
I was marginalised not only by the Australian culture because of the language barrier, but I also didn't feel that I fitted in with the Chilean community, although I was very active in the Chile Solidarity Committee. I think that a lot of my experiences in the first 10 years had a lot to do with me. I was in a constant depressed stage of my life. I mean, 10 years where I didn't do much. I mean, I studied the language and I learned English very quickly, but that was it. I mean, I never made a decision to go back to university, for instance.
When you are facing all that blackness, you know, you get closer or you find your own fight alone. So in that sense, we decided that we were fighting together. And has been always like that.
When you come here, you realize that you have to make it. You have to make it because you have another choice. It's not that after 2-3 years, if the thing doesn't work, I go back. You become very philosophical, and you become very passionate about what you are going to do. The most of the people make it. The main thing is here is that a lot of Chileans were still looking sometime back in a very nostalgic way. The Chile that was there in the 70s, the same corner shop with the friends, and it's not there anymore. And many Chileans went back to Chile with the possibility to come back there forever. And the shock for them will be sometime as great as when they come here in the first place.
We are in the black list because as soon all the political refugees left Chile, the military government made a special list with all those people. And they refused to give Chilean passport, firstly, and later, thanks to the International Solidarity Movement, they gave to us a Chilean passport with L. That means nationalist. So you were allowed to go any country except Chile. So when my mother-in-law died in 1978, Alicia, with the Australian citizenship, tried to go to Chile. And she went to the Chilean consul and say, no, you are not allowed to go because you are in the blacklist. So, some months later, my mother died. I tried to go to Chile to attend the funeral, and they don't give authorization to go there. And later, my father-in-law died. The same situation.
Some people managed to return to Chile during the dictatorship. Victor Marillanca and Juanita Zapata were amongst the first.
So I went as an Australian citizen in 1979 with my wife and my two-year-old son then. I went protected by the Australian government. So the Australian embassy in Santiago was aware that I was going and I might need some help. I was followed all the time. When I arrived to my father's place in Batuco, there were two guys with the army guys with their machine guns there, was running. And I took my son, he was 2 years old, so I took him on my arms, and my wife got all the luggage, and so just in case. So if they're going to shoot me, they will shoot me and my son. And even the people in the town there, they wouldn't talk to me, and some of them, they were very scared to come close, just in case if anything could happen.
I was very frightened. We didn't know what was going to happen to us. I was extremely, extremely conscious of myself, my body, my senses. I think went into an ultra tune. You know, I could hear everything that was happening, you know, miles away. I mean, they wanted to know exactly where and when we were going to stay at that time, and that was scary. It was an extremely emotional reunion. I saw my father, for instance, for the first time as an old man with grey hair, and I never expected that. It was extremely difficult to leave. That I can tell you why it was difficult to leave. In my view, what happened to me was that when you are sent on exile for the first time and being so young, first of all, you don't know how difficult it's going to be. You don't know the things that you're going to be confronted with. But also, I think that I have to be very honest that there is an element of adventure. And also, I think I had a taste back of what I was leaving behind. And that made it very difficult to accept.
Gana la gente su libertad. Ya viene el tiempo de la verdad.
Constitución política de la República. Juramento al presidente electo, señor Patricio Elwin Acosta.
It was a victory, but as many people of my generation say that it wasn't a victory. It was, but it wasn't. It was a victory in the sense that Pinochet wasn't there, so that's better. But it wasn't much, much better.
A plebiscite held in 1988 rejected Pinochet's continuation as president beyond 1990. In that year, free elections brought Christian Democrat Patricio Aylwin to power. While an uneasy standoff between the military and the civilian government replaced the dictatorship, the election result was the signal to return, at least for a visit. I went back with my mother soon after the return to democracy. The Chile I expected to encounter was a country made up of fragments of my parents' memories. We were both disappointed. Time and the corrosive effects of the regime had transformed Chile beyond recognition. It quickly became apparent to my parents that they could never live there again. On his return, Alexis Meza also experienced a similar sense of dislocation.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the non-smoking sign. At this time, please extinguish all smoking material.
Coming the plane into Chile, I saw the Andes mountain for the first time in 20 years, something that I never have seen in Australia, mountain like they are in Chile. And I really feel from that very minute, very much at home. And when I saw my family, in a matter of hours, we found ourselves in a situation that appeared to be that we never had lived.
Yes, it was a very strong and powerful experience. I gave to my family, my friends, a lot of love. And they were, in so many ways, extreme, because for so many years, the military government say all the Xi people, all the left people are communists and hate you, I won't destroy you. This was the propaganda used. But when they saw me, you know, as a human being, and hand them, you know, kiss them, you know, was a very strong experience for them, you know. Never they asked me, you know, how's your life in Australia, how hard you were, or whatever, you know. They have the opinion before I arrive, you know, be careful with that person because maybe he want to hit, you know, or he's upset or he's bitter, you know.
It's not that I didn't enjoy my stay in Chile, but after a couple of weeks, I realized that I am a very different person. And it's not that I didn't agree with what was going on and how the people sing in Chile. I feel that eventually I was in holiday there and I want to come back. I always saw that when you go to another country, you go there, you spend time in hotels, motels, and eventually you enjoy as much as possible the building, the scenery, the parks, knowing in the back of your mind that eventually when you start feeling tired, you got to go back home. And when that thought crossed my mind, I always saw Sydney as my home. Many people come back here saying or telling everyone how different Chile was, without realizing sometimes that maybe we were as different as the Chilean that we live. We have maybe changed more than the country there.
I love Australia. I love it if I was born here because it's so interesting, this country. But I am Chilean. I am Chilean. I am marked for that situation.
We don't have the economic means to go back and establish ourselves. But also, my son was born here and was brought up in this society. And this is where I think he's going to decide to stay. The more I go back to Chile, the more I realize that I don't belong there. And that's the punishment. That's what exile means. That sense of belonging is taken away from you. I mean, you're never, ever the same once you've been in exile, because you have gone through a very painful process. And by going through that painful process and being sort of and reached the stage of a survivor, that means that there is no return back.
You've been listening to Chileno Exiles, a feature made for Hindsight in 1997 by producers John Cochrane and Peter Jordan. Thanks to all those who told their stories. And for more information about today's program, just go to the Hindsight webpage. That's abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. There you can download a podcast of our programs or listen to them as audio on demand. I'm Michelle Rayner, and do join me for more Hindsight, this time next week, here on ABC Radio National. De decir que es un soplo la vida, que 20 años no es nada, que febril la mirada, errante en la sombra, te busca y te nombra, vivir con el alma ferrada.